Right. Hello, everybody. Thanks for coming. My assignment, which I was given only...
A little closer to the mic.
My assignment, only given to me only a couple of few weeks ago, was to give an overview of the controversy over the first vision and the different aspects of the controversy. So I'll dive right in. It's rather unfortunate that much of the discourse about the first vision has been dominated by the debate between Mormon apologists and their evangelical critics. But that is where Joseph Smith placed it when he chose to include the divine declaration upon the Christian world that all their creeds were an abomination and those professors were all corrupt. Thus, evangelicals are naturally offended and highly motivated to denounce Joseph Smith's claims. Even before the Reverend Wesley P. Walters famously raised the question about an 1820 Palmyra revival in 1967, evangelicals challenged the vision's historicity. Given the available sources, evangelicals noted that the vision seemed to pop into the historical record in 1838 without precedent. No one, not even Joseph Smith's family, mentioned the vision before he did. Why did Joseph Smith withhold such an important foundational event? They concluded it was another of Joseph Smith's fabrications. However, this approach was basically an argument from silence and therefore vulnerable to the discovery of new sources, which Mormon apologists gladly provided. Apologists soon found that these new sources raised additional questions, particularly with regard to apparent contradictions between the official and other versions of the vision. Chief among them is the apparent absence of God the Father in the unpublished 1832 account, which the evangelicals quickly exploited. In 1838, the Father calls Joseph by name, points to the other, and says, "This is my beloved son, hear him." In 1832, Jesus appears and says, "Joseph, my son, thy sins are forgiven thee." In the context of the Book of Mormon theology, where Jesus is both Father and Son, the Father according to the Spirit, and the Son according to the flesh, recognized as modalism or Sabellianism, his appearing alone and calling Joseph Smith's son makes perfect sense. In view of this, the addition of the Father is a theological anachronism and dates to some time after publication of the Lectures on Faith in the 1835 Doctrine and Covenants, where a similar modalistic definition of the Godhead is given. To escape this criticism, Mormon apologists have relied on some clever and not-so-clever ad hoc interpretations and are very similar to the evangelical attempts to explain away contradictions in the Gospels. Apologists have attempted to harmonize the various accounts by separating the elements of the stories from their literary contexts and comparing them on a highly abstracted level, while at the same time suggesting that Joseph Smith simply chose to include or suppress certain elements from his imaginary ideal version that existed in his mind. The problem with this approach is that it breaks down once you place the elements back into their historical and literary contexts. Apologists have also expended much energy defending the historicity of the 1820 revival in Palmyra, mostly dwelling on what Joseph Smith meant when he situated the revival in the place where we live, and said that from there it spread into the whole district of country. Defining these terms liberally, BYU professor Milton Backman suggested that Joseph Smith could have attended a revival as far away as 10 miles or more. This explanation wasn't satisfying to everyone, however, even in the Mormon community. For as Marvin Hill explained, it didn't take into account other elements that seemed to fit the 1824-25 setting better than 1820. Most notably, Joseph Smith's mention of the conversions of his mother and three siblings to the Presbyterian Church in her history, Lucy made it clear that she joined the Presbyterian Church after her oldest son Alvin's death in November 1823. Another element is the presence of Reverend George Lane, one of my ancestors, who, according to William Smith and Oliver Cowdery, preached a sermon on which church to join that impressed Joseph Smith. Well, Lane's participation in the 1824-25 Palmyra revival is documented. Apologists struggle to at least place him in the vicinity in 1820. More recently, in an extended ad hominem diatribe against Walters, D. Michael Quinn attempts to defend the 1838 account by constructing an elaborate ad hoc scenario that, among other things, redates the first vision to June 1820 instead of early spring, and then speculates that a June 1820 camp meeting near Palmyra was seen by Joseph Smith as the beginning of a protracted revival that 4 years later culminated in the conversions of his mother and siblings. Despite Quinn's imaginative reconstruction, he basically concedes the major findings of Walters' research, which makes his sustained attack on Walters perplexing. The weakness in Quinn's approach is that it rests on what Quinn thinks Joseph Smith was thinking, even that Joseph Smith incorrectly dated his vision due to an unusually cool early summer. Obviously, anything can be harmonized by such methodology. However, it is important to note that Joseph Smith had previously manipulated the order of his personal chronology when he helped Oliver Cowdery publish a history in the Messenger and Advocate in December 1834. Here, Joseph Smith used the same motifs, a revival, the Reverend Lane's preaching, sectarian competition for converts, mother and siblings joining the Presbyterian Church, confusion over which church to join, followed by a vision. However, this time it was in 1823 and preceded the vision of an angel revealing the location of gold plates. Given the fact that official histories are historically suspect anyway, Quinn's anxiety to support Joseph Smith's official history is misplaced. In my biography of Joseph Smith, I was less concerned about debunking the first vision than with understanding it both literarily and historically. In fact, I'm not one of those who deny the historicity of the first vision, although I have challenged the historicity of the 1838 account. I regard the additions of the revival, concern over which church is true, and the presence of God the Father as anachronisms, and give priority to the 1832 account. For me, the differences between the 1832 and 1838 accounts are profound and cannot be separated from their literary contexts. In the 1832 account, for example, Joseph Smith had already concluded, prior to his vision, that humanity had apostatized from the true and living faith, and there was no society or denomination that built upon the gospel of Jesus Christ as recorded in the New Testament. However, in 1838, Joseph Smith says, "For at this time it had never entered into my heart that all were wrong." Thus, the literary context of the two stories are different and incompatible. Particularly the 1838 claim that Joseph Smith was concerned about which church to join and was commanded to join none of them. I believe this concern is an anachronism for the 1820 setting and most likely dates to the 1824-25 revival when Joseph Smith's mother and three siblings joined the Presbyterian Church and began pressuring him to join. Evangelicals will no doubt point to the ease with which Joseph Smith manipulated the first vision as a reason for dismissing it altogether, which is not unreasonable. However, I think there is some evidence that the first vision story is based on some kind of an event that occurred in 1820 or 21, 1821 being the year given in the 1832 account. One possible allusion to the first vision is found in the Articles and Covenants of the Church of Christ, now known as DNC 20, dated April 1830, which states that prior to 1823, it was truly manifested unto this elder, Joseph Smith, that he had received a remission of his sins. An autobiographical reading of the Book of Mormon might provide the earliest allusion to Joseph Smith's early encounter with the divine. Of course, it's speculative to read the Book of Mormon in this way, and I offer it only as possible support for Joseph Smith's first vision. The irony in accepting this evidence is that one has to conclude Joseph Smith wrote the Book of Mormon, which might be a bigger problem to consider and a barrier for most Mormons. The evidence to which I allude is embedded in Mormons' biography in the Book of Mormon, which seems generally to parallel Joseph Smith's biography in several ways. Among other things, Mormon says there was an apostasy among the Nephites, where there were no gifts from the Lord, and the Holy Ghost did not come upon any because of their wickedness and unbelief, which coincides with Joseph Smith's 1832 account. Then Mormon states, "And I, being 15 years of age, and being somewhat of a sober mind, therefore I was visited of the Lord, and tasted and knew of the goodness of Jesus." Note that Mormon's age is the same as Joseph Smith's in the 1832 account. If based on Joseph Smith's 1820-21 experience, Mormon's description may contain the core of the experience that Joseph Smith later expanded, keeping in mind that being visited of the Lord and tasting the goodness of Jesus is not necessarily a vision of a personage. It could also be a charismatic experience, much like being born again. Nevertheless, if we give priority to the 1832 account and eliminate the anachronistic elements, such as the Palmyra Revival of 1824-25, the addition of God the Father, and Joseph's prophetic calling, the experience emerges as a personal epiphany in which Jesus appears, forgives Joseph of his sins, and declares that the sinful world would soon be destroyed. Not too unlike what some of Joseph Smith's contemporaries experienced. Whatever actually happened, it seems to me, as I have written, it had all the power and life-changing force of any mystical experience, and apparently represents his conversion from the Unitarian Universalism of his father to a belief in the divinity and atonement of Jesus. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. That was a lot in a short space. We appreciate that broad summary. And I want to kind of just point out a couple of things that Dan did here. And the first thing that happened, I think, that caused this controversy years ago with Reverend Walters and Michael Marquardt, is what we'd call multiple attestation, right? If you want to look at a historical event, you find out what are the instances where there's reliable reports of what happened, and the best place to go is Joseph Smith himself. Dan suggested this created a problem, because what you've got is, I think there are 11 that I count from 1844, about 11 accounts, a lot of them very short, a couple of sentences. The biggest one by far is the one we know in the Pearl of Great Price. When you read that, and I read this every week as a missionary in Brazil, our mission president had us read that story, and the impression you get is this is real history. I mean, it has the ring of history, doesn't it? I mean, it sounds plausible. It sounds, there was a great awakening in New York. It sounds all very realistic until you start preparing.
Sorry.
Until someone calls you on the phone and reminds you that these other accounts don't match. That was Dan's, and Dan pointed out here, it's the words of Joseph Smith himself when you compare them. It's not somebody criticizing, it's his own accounts that creates difficulties. Now, that's the first thing. So let's call that multiple attestation. The second thing that Dan brought up was historical setting. He pointed out things that we know about when revivals occurred, when people joined churches, and they don't seem to match the 1820 or 1821 account. So I'd say so far, that's what the discussion has been focused on. Multiple attestation of Joseph Smith that creates problems, his own words, and what we know about the history. it doesn't seem to match the setting. Now, what we'll look at is, I said that there were eight in the description, that there were eight tools that we could use. We're not going to be able to get around to all of them. What we may touch on is a third one, and that is the setting of the story itself. In other words, if Joseph Smith tells an account of the first vision, and it happens, let's say he gives it in 1835, and it matches 1835, what's going on then, but it doesn't match 1820, you have to be suspicious. It sounds like he's addressing the audience and not telling us what happened. Whereas, if it doesn't match the audience he's addressing and it matches 1820, that's a good reason to authenticate something. Okay? Now, there are other ways, and I'll just throw one out. The criteria of embarrassment. If Joseph Smith says something that looks embarrassing to him or the church, that's probably true. Because people don't say embarrassing things when they're telling their story. So we won't go through all the possibilities. I think we've given you enough here with what Dan's given you. Those two, and maybe the third one, that we can talk about. Let's present the evidence on five separate questions. And you have those in front of you. They're the five questions we're going to be discussing. Now, first of all, let me say about this. We're going to all vote, and we're going to see where you come in on these five questions. And the first one Dan mentioned already was the revival. Was there a revival? And we're going to take about 5 minutes for each one of us to address the question, and then we want to hear your thoughts. Maybe you have some thoughts or questions. Once we get that down, then we're going to vote. And red, you'll notice on your paper here, if you vote red, let's take the first one. Was there a revival in 1820? And we'll explain that in a little more detail. John Charles will take the first question. That says that it's certainly or virtually certain that this happened. Okay? There was a revival in 1820. Michael Quinn is one that espouses that. Okay? Or the statement is unequivocally accurate. That's a red vote. Okay? That gets 4 points. Some of you may say, well, I'm not so sure. You know, there really isn't a lot of evidence. Yeah, there's this summer revival, but Joseph Smith said he had the vision in the spring. It probably happened, but I'm not so sure. It probably happened, but it looks not certain. Then you would vote pink. The third is gray. The evidence indicates that it probably didn't happen. Okay, he said he had a vision in the early spring. The closest thing to it was a Methodist-only camp meeting, not all of these other religions. That I don't think that happened. I think something's wrong with the revival. Okay, and black is, this just didn't happen. Joseph Smith, maybe he, and this isn't negative, maybe he misremembered. Remember, this 1838 account is 18 years later. How well do you remember things 18 years earlier? We're asking a lot of Joseph Smith if we're asking him to give every single detail of what everybody said. Did he remember some later detail? Did he misremember? Was he just elaborating on the story and didn't catch himself? Black doesn't mean you disagree here with Joseph Smith. It just simply says that this particular detail, he didn't get right. Okay. Now, if you don't want to vote, that's fine. And maybe you haven't made up your mind. You don't. We wanted to do ballots where people would do these, anonymously. We figured that's just too much hassle. So if you feel like you don't want to vote because you don't know or you don't want to reveal your position, that's okay. Nobody will hold this against you, and I'm not sure how many of us will vote. We may or may not vote. We'll see. But so feel comfortable. We don't want you to feel, and nobody's going to remember here. We don't care about it, the individual. What we want is kind of a group take. Here's the evidence that Dan and John Charles and others have presented over the years. Let's just get a take of intelligent, thoughtful people, faithful people. What do you make of this? Right now, at this point, okay? That's what we want to do. We want to. So have you got this down now? The red has certainly happened, pink probably happened, gray probably didn't happen, and black is certainly didn't happen. So black is the most negative, red is the most positive. So we're going to start now. Any other questions about this? We're going to start with the first question. Take 5 minutes on each, then we'll get your input, your thoughts, if you have any questions. We want to make sure you're voting right. I mean, this is important. It's a presidential year. We don't want you to vote wrong. So please get all your questions answered. John Charles.
Okay. All right. So let's look at the first of the propositions, which is on the second page of your handout, where it says, number one, 1820 revival. The proposition, the claim made in the 1830 account is this.
Yeah.
That an unusual excitement on the subject of religion occurred in the place where Joseph's family lived not long before, early in the spring of 1820. That's the proposition. Now, let me sort of review in as mutual way as I can the evidence both for and against that proposition. So if we look, first of all, at the question of multiple attestations, we have an 1832 account that Joseph Smith gives us in his own handwriting of the first vision. We have an 1835 account that Joseph puts in his diary. He dictates to a scribe to put in his diary of the first vision. And then we have the 1838 account, the book that goes in the Pearl of Great Price. The 1832 account does not mention a revival. The 1835 account does not mention a revival. The 1838, of course, does. Some have argued on that basis that the revival is a later invention. On the other hand, the 1832 account does say that Joseph was concerned about the state of his soul and about contentions and divisions within Christendom, which one could argue is consistent with the 1838 account. The 1835 account, Joseph says that he was wrought up about religion and he didn't know who was right or wrong, which you could say was consistent with the 1838 account. And then to complicate things further, there's an 1834 account, not written by Joseph Smith himself, written by Oliver Cowdery, but apparently with Joseph's, you know, Joseph is the source for it, says there was a revival, names the main revivalist, Mr. Lane, he's called, and says that there was great contention as a result of his preaching between Baptists, Methodists, and Presbyterians. 1838 account doesn't mention Mr. Lane, but does say there was great contention between Baptists, Methodists, Presbyterians. All right, that's what we have in the existing attestation. Now, though, let's think about what we know about the historical setting based on other kinds of documentation. And here's where the big issue comes in. As Dan mentioned, Wesley Walters, an evangelical minister, argued back in the 1960s, I believe, that the 1838 account is not describing events that happened in 1820. It's describing a revival that happened between 1824 and 1825. And we know, based on other documentation, and this is what Walters presented, that, according to Walters, there was no dramatic revival in 1820. Churches in Palmyra, when you look at their membership records, either experienced very modest growth or actually lost members. However, in 1824 and 1825, lots of growth. He also says that George Lane, the guy who had been mentioned in the 1834 account, didn't preach in Palmyra in 1820, but he was in Palmyra 1824, 1825. The 1838 account says that the revival occurred in the second year after our removal to Manchester. Wesley does the calculation, says that would be 1824. Lucy Max Smith said that she joined the Presbyterians. Remember that the 1838 account says Lucy and some of the children joined the Presbyterians because of the revival? Lucy has an account where she says she joined the Presbyterians after Alvin's death because she was so distraught by his death. Alvin died in 1823. So Wesley presented all this information and says, it looks like the existing documentation that we have suggests that what Joseph is describing in 1838 is an 1824 revival, not an 1820 revival. And why does that matter? Because Moroni is supposed to appear to Joseph Smith. Anyone know what year? 1823. And so if this is true, it really scrambles up the chronology in a big way. Now, Walters did persuade many Mormons, both the kind of Mormons we might call revisionists and the Mormon apologists, that the 1838 account is describing an 1824-1825 revival. Many Mormons have been convinced of that. A sympathetic reading of that would be that Smith has kind of conflated the two in his memory. It wasn't a malicious misrepresentation, but it is kind of, they would have said, they would admit that, you know, he's not quite remembering it exactly as it happened. He's gotten things confused in his head. Now, some Mormon scholars have been more critical of Walters in order to defend the 1820 date. One of these is Milton Backman, who argues that there was a very vigorous revival in 1819 and 1820, not in Palmyra itself, but in the larger region. And he says that is consistent with what Joseph says in the 1838 account. As Dan mentioned, Michael Quinn has more recently argued that there was a major camp meeting for Methodists in Palmyra in 1820, which Quinn argues was big enough that it could qualify as the revival being described in the 1838 account. Though it's a little tricky, because that revival didn't occur until June, which would mean that when Joseph says in the 1830 account that he went in the early spring to pray in response to the revival, it wouldn't be what we think of as early spring. It would actually have to be in June of 1820 that he went to pray. And Quinn argues that that could, Smith may have remembered that as early spring because there was a very late winter, and so spring weather didn't start until later. That's his argument. All right, that in a nutshell is the data we have to work with. So now the question is, what do you think? Now, we'll field questions for at least a few minutes. We need to move on. We're going to do all five proposals in an hour. But let me just kind of recap with you what you see on the handout as sort of the options here. I want to emphasize that the options, as we've mapped them here, are not necessarily exhaustive. You may have other positions. But think of these as signposts. Like, which of these positions is most like yours? Red would be, you think that the events described in the 1838 account, the big revival, contention between Methodists, Baptists, Presbyterians, that all happened in 1820, just as the 1838 account says. That would be red.
At Palmyra.
Well, in the place where he lived. That's what the 1838 account says. Interpret that as you will. Pink would be, the 1838 account is basically accurate in describing a revival 1819, 1821, maybe we could say. In some details, maybe, it's conflating that with 1824, 1825, but it's basically correct in describing things that happened in 1819, 1821. That would be the pink position. Gray would be, this is mostly 1824, 1825 being described. Maybe there was a core event of 1820 being remembered here, but most of the details are, in fact, 1824, 1825. That would be your gray position. And black would be, no. What's being described in 1838 is simply events of 1824, 1825, which are being anachronistically dated to 1820. That's kind of the range of positions here. Questions to clarify anything before we take the vote? Other points you want to bring up, maybe a piece of evidence you're aware of that didn't show up in my summary? Yeah, Bob.
John Charles, it seems to me that in all of these, there's a basic problem. There's a new book out by Kevin Schultz called Wrong.
Bob, why don't you come up to the front? It sounds like you're going to go on for a little while, so let's make sure this is going.
Start saying that in some ways it seems to me that it would be helpful to, as a prelude to this discussion, to look at some of the new research in memory and cognitive processing, especially as it relates to a dynamic or a dramatic event. Catherine Schultz's new book out, which is titled Wrong, looks at a couple of things. One, how inclined we all are to be absolutely certain that we're right. And on just about every, but she cites some very interesting new studies on memory. And one of them, I just read this yesterday. Teachers or researchers having people give an account of, let's say, 9/11, your memory of what happened at 9/11. They write down this narrative. 8 months later, they ask the same question, write down a narrative. Then they show them the two narratives. And they're so absolutely different that in one instance, one of the researchers said, well, that's my handwriting, but I know that I didn't say that. And you look at an event. Let's say, for example, that the first division did take place, which would have been an absolutely startling event, certainly for someone who didn't expect that, as Joseph Smith says that he didn't. And he starts telling people about it, and then he stops telling people because this causes a lot of controversy. So there's a certain kind of editing that comes in pretty early on in the process because he's getting hammered for having said that he had this miraculous vision. But even if none of that happened, if Joseph Smith simply were to have written down in 1820 or 24 or whenever it was, this event is and the way all of his work, and this happens to you and it happens to me, you then write down an account the year later or 2 years later or 5 years later or whatever else. And what happens with memory is that most memory is constructed out of whole cloth. Most of the time we take an event here and an event there, and the mind constructs a memory which seems absolutely rational and so rational that we're sure that it happened. I'm starting to write my autobiography. It's called A Fable Not Agreed Upon. A life real and imagined, and the reason why I call it that is that I look back and start talking about things that happened in my childhood. I can't be absolutely certain they happened to me, or if someone told me they happened to me, or if I invented them happening. So it seems to me that one of the premises, one of the problems with trying to make sense out of these different things, especially when they are so far removed, and I'll say one more thing and then I'll sit down and promise. I use these different versions in my course in Mormon Studies at Graduate Theological Union. I give these to my students, the Jesuits, the Franciscans, the Lutherans, and I say, okay, here are the accounts, and let's talk about what they mean, or talk about the differences, and I talk about the issues that Dan and John Charles bring up about what, you know, what the historians have said, and go back and looking at this. And it seems to me it's absolutely reasonable to think that you're trying to remember, did this happen this year or that year, and was it before this or after that, or whatever else? And what happens is that you construct a narrative. Then, and in that earliest version, which is 1832, the reason I agree with Dan about its authenticity is you look at the imagery. The imagery in the 1832 version, Joseph talks about the heart. The later versions, the image of the mind is repeated. The heart, the images of the heart give way to the images of mind. In my mind, thinking, and what's happening, I think, one of the things to explain that is that Joseph Smith is having to construct a rational scaffolding for what happened. So, anyway.
Don't vote red. Let me say this response to Bob. Bob is, I think, let me speak to the defensiveness that I think is there. How you vote does not necessarily reflect whether you think Joseph Smith is being fraudulent or whether he's sincere. And also the question of what these votes might or might not mean for your testimony is an entirely different question. That's a whole other session, right? But let's use Bob's example, right? We have the account of 9/11 written right after it happened. I've got the account of 9/11 written 2 months later. There's differences. I, as a historian, have to figure out, well, which account do I think is most reliable? And that's the challenge we have here today, right? So we have an account that says, in 1820, these things happened. There are reasons to contest that, perhaps. So now we have to decide, how reliable do we think that 1838 account is on this issue of the 1820 rebund? And then we'll deal with other issues later, right? Should we vote?
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Our ward clerks are ready to tabulate your votes. So raise them proud. If you don't have cards, but you want to, well, we're going to do it a little one by, we're going to do it color by color. If you don't have a card, then you can raise your hand the right color. I want to see all the reds. The events in the 1838 account did occur during 1820 revival. Raise them high, raise them proud. Okay. Red. We're looking for red, not for pink.
No red.
We have no red. And that's how we know we're at Sunstone. All right.
Wow.
In saying that, I just gave several people on the Sunstone staff heart attacks. All right. Pink. The 1830 account is essentially accurate. Some details from 1824, 1825. Let's count them. And yeah, if your hand's up, get your hand to one. I count 14.
14. Okay. Yep. 14.
Gray. Some element from 1820, but mostly 1824, 1825 is being described. All right, raise them high. By the way, did you get my count too?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's.
Yeah. I am, and I'm voting. What am I voting on this? I'm voting gray.
I'm voting gray.
Right. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. I count 22.
Okay, I didn't count those. Let's count on rely on your word.
Black. It's 1824, 1825 being described. It's anachronistically placed in 1820.
Okay. Okay.
I count 15.
10, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16.
You
I
got
16. Let's do it again. Blacks again.
Black, white, and brown.
It doesn't have to be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
I still be 15. 10, oh, are you voting too, Dan?
13, 14, 15, 16. Yeah, okay, Dan,
that's right, 16.
You told me to.
He had to vote this
one.
All right. Well, we'll eventually, by the way, we're going to tabulate these to create a GPA, as you will, which will serve as the temperature of the room, the average in the room, just so that we kind of have some number we can hang our thoughts on. All right, let's move to the second one.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Just a brief comment on the memory thing, since it applies to each one of these, is the issue of memory is really not an issue in this situation, as John Charles mentioned, because we know that people intentionally change their stories to, you know, enhance their prestige or hide things. And we know that, sure, some people, bad memories do occur, but it doesn't help us in this situation. I mean, you can't know whether which one of those is occurring in this situation, and it really doesn't matter. We have to base our judgment on the text and what's happening with the different texts. Or, you know, is a revival being introduced where it shouldn't? It doesn't matter what Joseph Smith was thinking because we can't read his mind. So I think that's clouding the issue somewhat. My assignment was to, I'm glad I got this one, was the purpose of the prayer. Okay? What was the purpose of the Joseph Smith's prayer? Was it to obtain remission of sins, to ask which church he should join, or both? The 1832 history is unique in saying that the prayer was for remission of sins. This was consistent with the statement in DNC 20 that prior to 1823 it was truly manifested unto this first elder that he had received a remission of sins. The other accounts only mention that he was concerned for his eternal welfare in the sense of belonging to the true church. That's a very different thing. So when John Charles mentioned that some apologists try to abstract these two things and compare them as they're the same, that praying for remission of sins in 1832 is the same as praying for which church is true in both situations, entail his personal salvation, that they're the same. But each, when you put it back into the literary context, they're totally different. One, he doesn't care about which church is true, so he wants to know how he's going to be saved without a true church. You know, what about his sins? And he gets a remission of sins. The other one is that he's concerned over his eternal welfare. When you look at the wording of those accounts, it says that in the sense of, I have to belong to the right church, you know. So it's a completely different concern. Because Joseph Smith had previously decided that all the churches were apostate, he doesn't pray to know which church is true in 1832 account. Hence, there is also no mention of a revival and his confusion over which church to join. The 1832 account is written in Joseph Smith's own handwriting and says, from the age of 12 years to 15, I pondered many things in my heart concerning the situation of the world, of mankind, the contentions and divisions, the wickedness and abominations, the darkness which pervaded the minds of mankind. My mind became exceedingly distressed, for I became convicted of my sins, and by searching the scriptures I found that mankind had not come unto the Lord, but they had apostatized from the true and living faith, and there was no society or denomination that built upon the gospel of Jesus Christ as recorded in the New Testament, and I felt to mourn for my sins and the sins of the world. Therefore, I cried unto the Lord for mercy, for there was none else to whom I could go and obtain mercy, and the Lord heard my cry in the wilderness. And then he has a vision. Contrast this with Joseph Smith's 1838 history, where Joseph Smith says, during this time of great excitement, my mind was called up to serious reflection and great uneasiness. But though my feelings were often deep and poignant, still I kept myself aloof from all these parties, though I attended their several meetings as often as occasion would permit. But so great was the confusion and strife among the different denominations that it was impossible for a person young as I was and so unacquainted with men and things to come to any certain conclusion who was right and who was wrong. The first account of the first vision to mention confusion over which church to join is an entry in Joseph Smith's journal for the 9th of November, 1835, in the handwriting of Warren A. Cowdery, which records Joseph Smith's recital to Joshua, the Jewish minister, actually Robert Matthias. This account mentions that he was looking at the different systems taught by the children of men. I knew not who was right, who was wrong, and I considered it of the first importance that I should be right, in matters that involve eternal consequences. Being thus perplexed in mind, I retired to the silent grove and bowed down before the Lord. And then he has a vision. However, it doesn't mention the revival, and it doesn't mention a command to join none of the churches, only that his sins were forgiven. However, as I mentioned prior to this, Joe Smith had helped Robert Cowdery with an account of his 1823 vision of Moroni that was published in the Messenger and Advocate in December 1834. In this account, Methodist minister George Lane preaches in Palmyra and vicinity, which produces a great awakening or excitement on the subject of religion, and in the large and large additions were made to the Methodist, Presbyterian, Baptist churches. And this doesn't happen in 1820 with that June 1820 camp meeting. There's only a handful of conversions, and it doesn't spread from that camp meeting to any other religions. None of that happens until 1824 and 25. However, soon harmony was replaced by sectarian strife as a general struggle was made by the leading characters of the different sects for proselytes, and a cry, "I am right, you are wrong," was introduced. In this general strife for followers, his mother, one sister, I'm quoting Albert Cowdery still, and two of his natural brothers were persuaded to unite with the Presbyterians. This gives opportunity for further reflection to Joseph Smith, and he goes and prays. And then it says, on the evening of the 21st of September, 1823, and then the angel appears. Thus it appears quite plainly that Joseph Smith was willing to manipulate the chronology of his own history to get a certain message across to his readers. This question of the purpose of the prayer has great significance and interpretive opportunity. For if the 1832 history is given priority and is determined that Joseph Smith's prayer was for remission of sins, and that the vision only confirmed what he actually concluded or already concluded, then several elements in the story should be seen as anachronisms. Things like the revival, the conversion of his mother and siblings, asking deity which church to join, and the injunction to join none of them. The most likely time, as I said before, Joseph Smith would have been confused about which church to join was in connection with his mother pressuring him to join the Presbyterian Church following her own conversion in 1824-25. Joseph Smith has given us this clue himself. The revival he describes as beginning with the Methodists, particularly the preaching of Reverend Lane, spreading to other denominations in Palmyra, then to the region, and involving large additions to the churches, including his mother and siblings, did happen, just like that, except it was in 1824-25. At any rate, if you get this right and don't get hung up on apologetics, then other interpretive avenues open up. And as a historian, that's what I'm concerned about. So, you have your choice to
actually,
make...
Actually, Dan, let me walk through the rubrics.
You can do that.
Yeah, since I wrote the rubrics, it makes sense for me to kind of explain things. So, let's recap what's happening here. We have an 1832 account in which Joseph says, "I looked around at all the contention and division among Christendom. I was convinced all had apostatized. I was convinced there was no sect or denomination built on the gospel found in the New Testament. And so I had to go on my own to pray for forgiveness of my sins." That's what he says in the 1832 account. And you can see how arguably that you could argue that contradicts the 1838 account. Because in the 1832 account, it sounds like he knew or had decided all churches were true before he prayed. In the 1838 account, he says he didn't know which church to join, and that's why he prayed. This is the apparent contradiction some people have argued exists.
He said, "I'm convinced." You just said he said, "I'm convinced."
What was the exact wording here?
I don't think those were his exact words.
What was the exact word that he used?
Of what?
In terms of when he says, I believed all had apostatized, I knew all had apostatized, I knew there were no sects or denominations. In 32 language?
I read the whole thing because I thought it was so striking.
So what's the word he uses to describe how his knowledge? Okay, what he says is, "Searching the scriptures, I found that mankind did not come to the Lord, but that they had apostatized from the true and living faith, and there was no society or denomination that built upon the gospel of Jesus Christ as recorded in the New Testament." That's what he said. I found is the word. So what are the options here? We see, and I'm emphasizing seem because not everyone agrees there's a contradiction, but some would say there's a contradiction between these two accounts, right? Red, we're proposing, would be that no, there's no contradiction. Both the 1832 account and the 1830 account are accurate, they're compatible. He prayed for both. He prayed for forgiveness of his sins, and he prayed to know which church is true. We're envisioning that as a possible red vote. A pink vote might be the 1838 account is accurate, but I, the pink voter, am willing to recognize that that means the 1832 account is not quite accurate. He seems to have misremembered in 1832, and he got it right in 1838. That would be what we're envisioning as a pink vote. A gray vote would be, no, the 1838 account is not accurate. He prayed, or, well, let's rephrase it. It's mostly inaccurate. So the 1838 account is not accurate, but 1832 is. So he did pray for forgiveness of his sins, as he remembered in 1832. And when he says in 1838 that he prayed to know which church is true, that's the inaccurate one. Black might be, they're both historically inaccurate. He's inventing the entire thing in the 1830s. It doesn't reflect anything that happened in the 1820s at all. And some people have argued that. Some people think the entire First Vision accounts are inventions of the 1830s. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So again, the options. Red, 1838 and 1832 are fully compatible. He prayed for both reasons. Pink would be, he did pray to know which church was true, which means 1832 is wrong. Pink would be, no, he prayed for forgiveness of his sins, 1838 is wrong. Black would be, both wrong, both inaccurate. Okay? Red, a question?
Question.
Go for it.
You may have covered this too, and I apologize.
Okay.
I'm a little dense, I admit.
I'm going fast.
So is there a reason, what's the main arguments for an anachronistic view of him saying, hey, oh, by the way, I was also going to pray. So it says that usually first, you know, the first response and the first attestation is the correct one that most historians will go with. It's like, hey, let's go with this 1832.
Right, the closer you are to the event, the more likely it is to be true.
More likely it is true. Well, is there a reason why he would, did the atmosphere change between 1832 and 1838 that made him say, hey, you know what, by the way, also, I was going there to pray to find out which church is true. Why would he change? Is there a reason?
So if I understand what you're asking is, so if we're going to say that the 1832 isn't accurate, but 1838 is, what would be the reason for thinking 1838 is more accurate?
Or the other way, actually the other way. Like, why is the 1832, well, why would he revise his story? Why would he?
That's a great question.
That's a terrific question. And that gets back to Bob's issue here. As people change, they tell the same story the same. You read the 1832 account, and it sounds like a personal experience. What's interesting about the First Vision is his family didn't talk about it. William, late in his life, starts with the Book of Mormon. You want to know about the Restoration? Well, it starts with the Book of Mormon. Lucy doesn't mention it. And I know that William knew about the First Vision. He says, if you want to know about Joseph Smith's early life, read his account. We already know about it. Well, he was referring, so he knew about it. So Joseph Smith quite clearly was telling a personal tale in 1832. A personal, unvarnished tale. In 1838, he was being hammered. They'd just been driven out of Missouri. And now, for the first time, he sees the First Vision quite clearly as an emblem of his whole prophetic calling. He sees it entirely differently. And maybe that's why he tells it differently. So the question is he misremembering, or is he just remembering different details from a personal account to a kind of grand prophetic call, which you don't see that in the 1832 account.
All right, let's do the vote.
One quick question.
Yeah, go for it, Bill. Of course.
So it seems, though, like there's something between gray and black here. So, like, I just want to make sure. I want to know how to vote.
Maybe muddy brown.
So if you think that Joseph Smith isn't lying, that he did go into a grove and did pray, and did have a profoundly spiritual experience, but you don't believe that Jesus Christ and God actually appeared, where do you vote?
So your question is, like, what if you believe that he was sincere in believing it happened, but it didn't really happen?
Yeah, right.
No, the question is why he prayed. We're not even to the vision part.
Well, except that Black says you reject that he even that he created the whole story about praying.
Yeah.
The question of what, whether or not you think, you know, sincerity versus actually having, that will come up later.
Okay,
let's try to bracket that.
Sorry,
for now.
I jumped the jump.
Yeah. But on the other hand, like we said from the outset, these are not necessarily exhaustive options. It's more a question of figuring out, you know, okay, which color is most like my own? Yeah, we could parse these like multiple colors, like teal, I don't know what else. Red. You think that both 1832 and 1838 are compatible. Joseph prayed for both reasons. Raise them high, raise them proud. I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12.
12. Yeah, I get 12.
All right. Pink. You think 1838 is accurate, which means 1832 was not accurate. Raise them high, raise them proud.
Nobody.
Interesting. Greg. 1832 is accurate. He prayed to know, for forgiveness of his sins, he did not pray to know what church is true. Raise them high, raise them proud. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30. I get 30.
I lost count. Let's count to
30. Hi, man. Sorry, guys.
Close enough.
Did you count Dan?
Oh, I have you up.
Okay, you got to get Dan.
Oh, and I'm great, too. Sorry, so that's
32. 32.
32, sorry.
Well, I'd add me, 33. I'll
33. All right, black, neither account is accurate.
Okay.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12.
12.
I get 12. All right, let's see if we can get the last three. We're pressed for time, but let's do it.
Okay, yeah. Okay, who's next? Yeah, you're done. Okay. Saw two personages. That's me.
I think probably
two
persons.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay, this is fairly simple. Here's the words in the 1832 account. It seems to be, we keep driving back to, you know, there's other accounts, but this one seems to be one that people favor. Okay, a pillar of light above the brightness of the sun at noon came down from above and rested upon me, and I was filled with the Spirit of God, and the Lord opened the heavens upon me, and I saw the Lord, and he spoke unto me, saying, Joseph, my son, thy sins are forgiven thee. So the Lord appears to Joseph Smith. Now in 1835, one being appears, an unnamed being, a second. After he speaks, a second being comes down. They testify that Jesus is the Son of God. So you have two beings. They appeared at different times. Then he said, I also saw many angels. Then the account that we're most familiar with is Joseph Smith looks into the light and sees two beings. One points to the other and said, this is my beloved son. Hear him. Now, some people have said, these are compatible. I mean, you know, lots of beings appeared in the first one. He simply mentions the Lord. You know, that doesn't mean there weren't other beings there. So the first possibility here is the 1832 and the 1838 account are both accurate and compatible. Joseph Smith prayed.
Number three.
I'm on the wrong one. We've already done that. There was no significant reason to doubt that Joseph Smith saw or believed he saw two personages in 1832. He simply didn't tell everything he saw. Okay. Now. Okay, that's certain people have argued, well, this is interesting, as Dan pointed out earlier, that early Mormons believed in that God was one being. There was one. You look in the Book of Mormon, Alma and Amulek say, they're asked the question, Ammonihah, how many gods are there? There's one. When Abinadi speaks, he said, God will come down among his people, and because he takes on flesh, he will be called the Son of God. He is the Father and the Son, which is one God. That seems pretty clear to me, that the Nephites believed that there was one God. They didn't believe in three separate gods. But we've gone through all sorts of contortions, and so what would Mormons believe? Of course early Mormons would believe what they were raised with, three in one, and whether it's the Book of Mormon or what they were believe that there was one essence and three persons, and we can get into all of those details. But by 1835, as Dan has already pointed out, we started saying that there were that God and Christ were separate persons. And then, of course, we know late in Joseph Smith's life, he said, God has a physical body. Christ has a physical body. They're separate beings. That's late. We want to read back, and we do it all the time. The first vision, all of a sudden, Joseph Smith comes to the conclusion that God has a body. Well, why would he? I mean, he wouldn't necessarily do that. He didn't
asked the wasn't revealed in there, but we seem to think that everything that Joseph Smith knew and thought about the Godhead was revealed in 1820. So we've got to rethink that. So the first question is, how many beings? That's really what we're talking about. Was the 1832 account just giving us a few part of the story? Given the evolution of Mormon view of the Trinity, are those compatible? The second possibility is you can't say for certain, but most likely conclusion that Joseph saw two personages in vision, not one. So it's probable, but we can't be sure. Gray, probably didn't happen. We can't say for certain, but the most likely conclusion is that Joseph had a vision of one personage, the Lord, which he later embellished into two. Again, he misremembered, or, you know, this is 18 years later, remember. He may have mixed up this vision with some other vision. He had lots of visions, so who knows what happened. I don't know. But that's your conclusion. He really only saw one being, and he misremembered or misapprehended or read his own current theology back in. And black is, it didn't happen. The evidence very strongly indicates that Joseph Smith embellished a vision of one person into two, so you're more certain with black. There was really only one person, and he just didn't get it right. The details weren't right later on. Any questions on that? What we're voting on?
Is an auditory vision considered a vision?
Wow. So a voice.
Yes, your voice telling you that
your sins are forgiven you. Interesting.
Manifestation.
In the 1832 account, he does see the Lord. He doesn't just hear a voice in 1832. He says he saw the Lord.
That's right. Okay, so we are seeing things, but that's an interesting... That takes us too far on a different question, actually. Yes.
Are we addressing the issue of whether he saw with his natural physical eyes or his spiritual eyes?
I think what we need to say here is that we're addressing Joseph Smith's experience.
Yeah, we're not talking about...
Well, I just want to say, that's why in square brackets when I drafted this red option, I said saw or believed he saw. This also speaks to your concern, Morris. Yeah, we're bracketing that question.
Yeah.
The question is, did Joseph have an experience in which he saw... What do you think about the objective reality? That we can make that a separate question.
Yeah.
Okay.
George, should we do
that? Let's vote, yeah.
Okay. So, you have the options. Red... Unequivocally accurate.
Well,
he saw two visions. He saw two persons.
Oh, I see.
I see two votes. I feel like an auctioneer. Three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine. I get nine.
Nine. Compatible. The compatibilists. Okay. Yes,
so
for you.
Okay. Pink vote. We can't say for certain, but probably saw two. A little less certain, but probably saw two. I got one pink vote, I got two pink votes, I got three. I feel like an auctioneer. All right, fuck, get up in the air. Come on. You're so American. You wait to see how everyone else votes before you vote. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. All right, I got seven pinks.
One more red.
You want to say one more red?
One more red. Okay.
All right. Greg, can't say for certain, but probably one person later embellished into two. One, two, three, four, five. 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, plus me, I get 16.
Two.
And black, you're quite certain it was one person later in Belgium.
Maybe not.
Oh, we got a lot of blacks.
Or it didn't happen at all. Yeah, that, you can call that black too. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. You're going black? So 21.
21.
All right, that's the next one.
Clear.
This one's me.
Okay.
So, was Joseph commanded in his vision to join none of the sects? That's the question. And here's the evidence we have to work with. This is basically just a question of internal attestation. So, in 1832, the one Joseph writes in his own handwriting... doesn't say that he was told not to join any sects. Doesn't say that. However, on the other hand, the Lord does tell him that none do good. No, not one. They draw near me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. That should sound familiar because that shows up in the 1838 account as well. 1835, Joseph does not say he was told not to join any of the sects. He does say in 1835 that he wanted to know which religion was right and which was wrong. But he never tells us what the answer he was given was. Okay. And then, of course, we have the 1838 account, which in which the Lord appears and says, don't join the sects, and says the famous line that's kind of made people uncomfortable since then about the creeds are an abomination and the passes are all corrupt, the strongest language that appeared in any of the earlier accounts. Let me mention here that there is some external evidence that comes into play, which has to do with the fact that there's opposing data as to whether or not Joseph joined churches in the 1820s. Right? Some people have said, well, if you can find evidence that Joseph joined a church in the 1820s, that might give you reason to doubt that he had a vision that told him not to join the churches. And the evidence is really mixed. And all of the evidence that we have comes from later. I mean, Joseph's actual religious activities in the 1820s are pretty much a black box until you get to the production of the Book of Mormon, meaning we don't have contemporary data, we only have later recollections. But I'll just run through this really quickly. Some sources from the 1870s and the 1880s describe Smith as rejoining either the Baptists or the Methodists or the Presbyterians. Different people remembered all three. On the other hand, there's a source from the 1860s which remembers that Joseph joined a Methodist class in Palmyra around 1820 and then showed up one day and said, I'm withdrawing because you're corrupt. Well, I don't want to put words in his mouth. He says all churches have a false foundation, and he withdraws from the class. And some people have said, oh, that seems to provide evidence for his having had a vision in 1820 saying don't join the churches. There's also some evidence, some people remembering, Lucy, Max Smith, his mother, remembers that when she became a Presbyterian, Joseph comes to her and says, well, you can do what you want, but I have no desire to join a church. I can learn more by studying the Bible in the woods in 2 hours than you could learn by listening to sermons for 2 years. And he then goes on and says, you know, he then refers to a particular Presbyterian deacon in the area. He says, that guy is selfish, and if a widow and her child were poor, he would take their last cow from them. So, which, again, you could argue is consistent with the view expressed in 1838 about professors being corrupt. So, again, data points kind of all over the map here. Questions about that? Yes.
I wonder how permeable the church walls were. Put differently, was it common for the pastors to receive unbaptized visitors on a routine basis? Or in order to hear a sermon, did you have to be baptized in anything? What was the common practice today?
There are different practices, but to speak more specifically to the question of Joseph Smith's involvement in the churches, the people who are remembering things, like the guy who remembers going to the Presbyterians, as I recall, he remembers him attending a Sunday school, which is not necessarily the same as joining. The Methodist class that people remember him joining, he joined the class, but that's not quite the same as joining the church yet.
You can even be an exhorter without being a Methodist member.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Were people church hopping?
Was church hopping common?
Oh, yeah, people, people join and unjoin.
You needed to have a ticket to get into the Methodist class. That was the Methodist gathering. And they would give temporary tickets to people for a little while, and they would give them on probation for a little while. You could for 6 months or a few weeks to see if you were going to join. But they were pretty exclusive because they would stand up and point out sins of people. You did this, and I mean, it was really kind of embarrassing. So they were pretty exclusive. They would let people who were investigators kind of come in temporarily, but it wasn't an open meeting. So what's the claim is here is Joseph Smith, people, a couple of sources, both pro and con. The argument was, well, he was only there a little while. No, he was there 6 months. That was the argument. Nobody argued that he never was there. He was a temporary. He was never admitted as a permanent member, so he was kind of investigating. A temporary kind of member.
So, of course, even if he's investigating these churches, one could argue that would seem to undermine the claim that in 1820 he had a vision saying, don't join the churches. That becomes the argument. Other questions? Okay, so let's look at our options here. Need my cards. So as the red option, we're envisioning something like this. Joseph was in fact commanded in his vision not to join the churches. He just didn't preach that till 1838. That's why it doesn't show up in the earlier accounts. That would be a red vote. Pink vote, we can't say for certain. The most likely conclusion, though, is that he was told in a vision not to join the churches. Gray vote, can't say for certain, but probably didn't happen. Black vote, evidence very strongly indicates that no, he did not have a vision telling him not to join the churches. The 1838 account is not accurately reporting that. Okay? So, red happened. Joseph had a vision telling him not to join the churches. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. I get seven. Pink. can't say for certain, but probably was commanded in a vision not to join the churches.
One, two.
Okay, let's start. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I get 11.
Yep.
11 for the pinks. The gray can't say for certain, but probably did not have a vision telling him not to join the churches. 14 plus me is 15?
Yeah, I got 15, yeah.
Okay. And then black, evidence very strongly indicates, did not have a vision telling him not to join the churches. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. I get 21, 22, 23.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to make it. Last one.
Okay.
3 minutes. 2 minutes.
Oh, we've got 15.
Oh.
15. Yes.
How many grays and blacks were there?
Grays and blacks. The number of grays was 16 and the blacks were 21.
Fascinating variety here. I mean, this is interesting to see. We're all over the board. Okay. I think, if anything, this points out this is a tough question. And I'm glad, Bob, you said what you did, because I think this points out these are not easy questions. Okay, the final one, persecution. When Joseph Smith told his story, men of high standing excited the public mind against me and created a bitter persecution, and this was common among all the sects, all united to persecute me. Okay. Now, let me tell you what Mormon historians have been able to discover about persecution. The Smiths were kind of outsiders. They were poor, you know, and they felt it. They knew it. Joseph Smith, I don't think, ever got over the fact that he barely could read for the rest of his life because they didn't have money to go to school. It was really, really difficult. Smart people who didn't have the obvious advantages that they should have had. So they felt like outcast. I think there's clear that there was a social division there. That much we know. Now, acts of persecution. Lucy tells about sometime in mid-teens, a bullet whizzed through the house as Joseph Smith was walking to the door. They go out, and the next day find out where, they don't know who it was, what happened. Was this a misfire? Was this persecution? Was this an accident? Who knows? Of course, I think people would read it as an accident. I mean, it's a persecution, but we can't for sure say, but that's one act that could be called persecution. Late in his life, one of the residents near their home said Joseph Smith, some of his friends, took him and threw him in a pond of water because of his beliefs. A late account, was this a prank? Was this what was this? That's about it. I don't know of anything else that we've got other than the normal, social frictions, people saying these people were shiftless and, they go out hunting for money and... So there was some social strain, but there's not a lot there. Now, so what I would like to propose here, that's the 1820 setting, 1821. What we do know, when the story was told in 1838, there's this vicious, Joseph Smith says, people of the highest order were stirring up people to the most bitter persecution. He told that in 1838, when there was an extermination order to kill Mormons, to drive them out. Joseph Smith was furious. He says, you write down your stories. We're going to get back at this. This will not rest, as George Bush said. We are not going to let this rest. You could tell in his telling of the first vision story, why did they persecute me? I just don't understand it. All of this severe, bitter, bitter persecution from every level of society. They were all united against me, he says. That sounds a lot like 1838.
Was that the year the extermination order by Governor Boggs was?
When was that year?
When was that?
The extermination order. They were just driven out of Missouri, so it was just prior to that, the extermination order.
The extermination order was?
Now, let's look back at this again. What other evidence can we find? I mean, visions were common. People had visions. These were revivals. I mean, they were intensely religious, looking for God. To have to see visions of angels or God or hell. They were whipping people up pretty well. I mean, this was a terribly emotional time, and people would have visions, and they were terribly distraught about the forgiveness of their sins. Some people thought, this is just nonsense. Visions, I mean, you know, people, get a grip on yourself. You know, the Congregationalists would say, you know, can't you people talk religion without becoming fanatics about it? Other people, Lorenzo Dow was a Methodist. He was like Joseph Smith. Visions, yep, I think they're in our day. But he was kind of off. People were nervous about him. And Joseph Smith, the Methodist, didn't quite feel comfortable about Joseph Smith, clearly, because there were other people that said, yeah, a vision, yeah, okay, that's secondary. The Bible is really where the gospel is. That's the kind of traditional thing. If you have a vision, maybe, you know, you get forgiveness of sins, that's fine, but you're not going to get any doctrine out of it. There are a lot of Methodists like that. And Methodists were pretty, you know, they were pretty emotional. One, I remember in the area here, there was a reading the story in the Methodist history of in the area that was replaced. This very fiery preacher was replaced by a rather calm, peaceful, and loving minister. And at the closing of the prayer, at the end of this session, one of the members of the Methodist class said, Heavenly Father, we thank thee for our new elder, traveling elder that's come here, and we ask you, thee, to give him more religion. He wasn't screaming and throwing hell, and, you know, so, this was a wild, this was really wild time, and so a lot of people had visions, yeah, but they were controversial. They were in Palmyra, people would have visions even. But they were controversial, and not everybody had them. Then there were those that believed, the only time you have visions is in the Bible. All this stuff is nonsense. So you had a wide range. There was a Baptist, for example, that had a vision in the 1820s, and he considered himself persecuted and ridiculed for having visions. Okay, yeah, so these kind of radical visionaries, not the ones that thought of forgiveness of sins, but there were people that, you know, believed in doctrine and believed in seeking for God in a new way. They were certainly ridiculed. But what we're getting here, so that's a little background. What we're getting here is Joseph Smith saying, men of high standing excited the public mind against me with bitter persecution. You really can't appeal to this, and Dan's used this argument, just because nobody mentions it. You know, where are the paper accounts? The family mentions nothing about this bitter people. Okay, they throw him in the water? Is that what we're talking about? You know, I mean, if this bitter persecution happened, it was never written down. This bitter, antagonistic persecution. So the question before us is, accurate. Joseph Smith experienced widespread and bitter persecution because of his vision. People just didn't write it down. They already had tension there. They just, why bother? You know, okay, there's a bullet shot. Maybe that's part of it. So red is, yeah, Joseph Smith was describing this, but people didn't bother. Again, I think Bob brought up the point. Maybe they went silent because they realized, you know, let's just hang low, don't talk about it, and forget about it. Okay? So that's number one. The silence is simply just people hanging low and not mentioning anything in any histories. Second one, most accurate, probably happened. Probably Joseph Smith was ridiculed for his vision, but the 1830 account likely exaggerated the extent and severity. He's in the middle of persecution, so he's pretty upset. And so he exaggerates it a bit. Yeah, it makes sense that, you know, people would ridicule him. See God, all this stuff happening, you're just wacky. You know, okay, that's the persecution. Probably didn't have it. Joseph Smith likely reading later persecutions back into the setting in his first vision. He probably was not persecuted at the time. Okay? And finally, you lovers of black, informal design. It didn't happen. There's no record of it. Okay, so somebody threw him in the water. That's not persecution. I mean, and if he was so greatly persecuted, where's the record? It seems like nobody even bothered to mention that he had a vision until way later. They were, you know, this is some personal experience that nobody paid attention to. So silence is kind of the black. He might have had a vision, but basically, so did half the neighborhood.
Question?
Yes.
Yeah. Can I make a
Dan.
Quick little statement about the persecution?
Okay.
Well, actually, Joseph Smith was persecuted in his early years, and there are records of it.
Ah.
Not the bitter persecution. I think you're right about trying to blend Missouri. Although, my friend Perry Porter Googled it back there and found out that the extermination order was October 1838.
Okay.
And the writing of the history is May Same here.
Okay.
So, but they're still being persecuted since 1833, you know, in Missouri. Now, what Joseph Smith was being persecuted for was not for the vision, but for money digging. And he was taken to court and tried in March 1826, and he was rejected all over the place for his magic and things like that. But when I analyze the 1838 account and we find elements from 1824-25, I believe that he could have been persecuted in 1824-25, but not for the first vision, but for telling the story of the plates and the magical elements with that story would have raised the ire of a fellow Methodist. Yeah. When Joseph Smith goes home, and he says he was talking to one of the Methodist preachers, which could be some of his friends, he said that the Methodist minister rejected his first vision. He's blending it because there were no more revelations. And that his 1832 account, if that's true, would not have raised any eyebrows because those kind of visions were quite common. But if he told the minister about the plates and the angel, that makes more sense why he said that there's no more revelations or done away with, you know, because the Bible is, like, complete.
Great clarification. We got to get moving here because the tape turns off in 5 minutes. So the point is that Joseph Smith was persecuted from the 1820s for a variety of reasons. He had great stories about those persecutions. I wish we could talk about him. Terrific stories. He was really great with persecution. I mean, brilliant about how he handled stuff. We won't go into this. He was really quite interesting about how he handled it. But again, let's ignore all of that. So we've got Missouri persecution. We've got the people trying to get him in Palmyra, in Manchester, for money digging. So what we're saying is, for the first vision. That's what we're voting on here. Okay, so let's go ahead.
So, the options again. Red, Joseph did experience widespread bitter persecution for telling about his vision the way he described it in 1838. Raise him high, raise him proud. One, two.
Two.
We got two.
Two.
We're now two or three witnesses. Pink. It's probable he was ridiculed for telling about his vision, but he may have exaggerated the severity of that persecution. All right. One, two, three. I get 17.
How many?
17. Gray. Joseph is likely reading later persecutions back into the setting of the first vision. He probably wasn't persecuted at that time. I get 19 with Dan.
Okay.
And black,
dark
it's...
Gray.
We're calling it gray, okay? Black, it's virtually certain that Joseph's claim that he was persecuted for telling about his vision is not historical, it's untenable. With me, 13. All right, we're now going to tabulate. He's going to finish tabulating the results. We can tell you sort of the GPA, the temperature in the room for each of the five statements. Actually, I can start reporting the first as he's tabulating the last one.
Okay.
All right, so to recap, for question one, was there an 1820 revival? Our numbers were 0 red, 14 pink, 22 gray, 16 black, which comes out to a GPA of 1.9, which is gray. Question two, what was the purpose of Joseph's prayer? Our figures were 12 red, 0 pink, 33 gray, 12 black. Comes out to a number of 2.2, which is again gray, though less gray than we were for question one. A little pinker. Question three, how many personages did Joseph see in the vision? We had 10 reds, 7 pinks, 16 grays, 21 blacks. That's a total of 2.1, again, gray. The command not to join any of the churches. We had 7 reds, 11 pinks, 15 grays, 23 blacks, which gave us a total of 2.0. Again, gray. Though still, our lowest figure so far has been for whether there was an 1820 revival. Was there, okay, persecution. We have 2 reds, 17 pinks, 19 grays, 13 blacks. That gives us a total of 2.1. Again, that's gray. So we are a very gray group, which I'm sure the apologist boards will have a heyday. Thank you all for coming. I hope this was fun. Again, let's recap. This just tells us the temperature in the room for what we think about the historical reliability of the account. Whether you think it was sincere or fraudulent is an entirely different question. What all of this actually means for your testimony is, again, an entirely different question. But in terms of weighing historical evidence, this is where this room happens to come out. Thank you all.